Good evening, and welcome to VPR's Eye on the Sky Stargazing Party. I'm Rick Singeri. Tonight's program is presented in collaboration with the Fairbanks Museum and Planetarium in St. Johnsbury. Our guest is Mark Breen, who you know from the Eye on the Sky Weather and the Night Sky program at 4:30 every day on VPR. Mark is also the Planetarium Director at the Fairbanks Museum and has extensive knowledge about the night sky. This year, things are just a little different, though. Mark's joining us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks for joining us tonight, Mark.
Glad to be here, Rick.
All right. Now, to start off with, what are you doing in Philadelphia?
Yes, that is a good question. I'm actually down here for a planetarium conference. And when I found out that the two events were basically scheduled at the same time, our annual star party and this conference, I thought, how can I make that work? And I actually have a friend that down here at WHYY, and we made some phone calls and coordination, and so here I am.
And they wouldn't reschedule the conference for you?
No, apparently not. It's actually one of my favorite conferences. It's called LIPS, which is kind of an odd acronym. It actually means Live Interactive Planetarium Symposium, and it's interesting because while a lot of planetariums around the country do a lot of automated programming, the planetarium at the museum continues to do live shows. And so this is a group, and they kind of come from all over the country, people that want to do live programming in planetariums. And, of course, we all know the value of live programming right here with the live radio. So that's what the conference is about.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Now let's turn to our skies tonight. What are we seeing weather-wise around Vermont right now?
I've been checking in, and the skies continue to gradually clear out. It looks like it's a little bit clearer over across parts of the Adirondacks and St. Lawrence Valley. But that clearing is progressing eastward, so I'm optimistic that, one, as folks go out, they'll be able to start seeing some of these things we describe. But, two, as we'll talk about a little bit later, the best viewing of meteors actually takes place after midnight. And so, with clearing continuing to progress, I think after midnight there'll be some better viewing.
Oh, that's fantastic news, Mark. Okay, listeners, you can grab a blanket and a radio, head outside, and look up. Before you do, call us with your questions or let us know what you're seeing. Call 1-800-639-2211. Our number again, 800-639-2211. You can also email community@vpr.net. We'll be taking you on a tour of the stars, planets, and constellations, answering your questions. We'll also be watching for the Perseid meteor shower. So, Mark, let's get oriented. First of all, will we see any planets in the sky tonight?
All right. Well, I think if I just simply had folks go outside, look for the brightest things you can find. Obviously, you'll see the moon. We've got a quarter moon out there right now. But to its left, you will see three bright objects. They kind of make a triangle. The brightest of the trio is the planet Mars, kind of an orangish or kind of almost a rusty red color to it. To its left is a similar colored object, just a little bit lower, not quite as bright, and maybe even a little more reddish in color. That is Antares, a star. And then above the two, kind of a pale white color, or pale yellow white color, is the planet Saturn. Saturn is just a little bit dimmer than Mars, but they really make for an excellent trio up there. And now we're, by the way, looking toward the south, actually a bit south-southwest, as we're viewing those three.
Wow, that sounds beautiful, doesn't it? Now, the reason we have this stargazing party in August, Mark, is because of the Perseid meteor shower, which is in evidence at this time every year. So I guess we should start with, what is a meteor?
Right. A meteor, a small fragment of rock, sometimes metal, but primarily it's rock, and it comes zipping into our atmosphere. Now, it's, you know, common name. People still talk about shooting stars and falling stars because in some ways it does look like this object is falling out of the sky. And so that's how people described it, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago. And, you know, so we kind of stick with that in a little bit. But we now know that this is actually taking place in our atmosphere. So these are little tiny fragments of rock that burn up as they come into the atmosphere. And for the most part, particularly with meteor showers, they don't reach the ground. There are some meteors that do reach the ground. In fact, they get a slightly different name as a result. They are called meteorites. And they do, you know, sometimes the larger pieces are large enough that they survive that trip through the atmosphere and they reach the ground.
So this meteor shower is happening all year round, but we just happen to come into its orbit, or we orbit into its path at this time of year. Is that the idea?
Well,
you can say
there
now.
Are specific meteor showers through the year. And so this one, for example, in August, takes place every year in August. That's where the debris is that basically we're running into.
Yeah.
And so we end up with seeing meteors specifically August 11th, 12th, 13th, but there are other meteor showers during the year as well. Some of the better known ones would be the Leonid meteor shower in November. There's the Quadranted meteor shower, not a household name, but often there's some pretty good meteors to be seen in January, for example.
And so what about the moon? You said it's a quarter moon tonight. Does it have a role in all this? Does it affect our viewing of the meteors?
Yes, and that certainly will curtail at least some of the viewing during the evening. The moon, when it's half full, what we call a quarter moon, is actually 10 times less bright than a full moon. So it's not, you know, a terrible washout kind of situation, but it is a setup where it will basically kind of wash the sky with a little bit of moonlight. And that means the fainter meteors will be difficult, if not impossible, to see. However, you know, every year the moon is positioned slightly differently, and so it's not always going to interfere. This year it actually is timed okay. It won't really help out this evening, but the moon will be gone out of the sky by, say, midnight or 1 o'clock, and as a result, after midnight or 1 o'clock, we'll have darker skies, and we'll see it a little bit better.
That's fantastic. All right, we're starting to get a shower of questions here. First of all, Sarah in Barnet says, we'll be listening to you from outside of the Northern Skies Observatory in Peacham, which you know quite well, Mark. And
yes,
she asks, it seems to me that in wintertime, the stars appear to be brighter here in the Northeast Kingdom than they are in the summer. Why is that, or is that just my imagination?
Well, no, I wouldn't say it's imagination. Generally, it has to do with just our general atmosphere. During the winter months, as we well know, some of our air comes out of northern Canada. And the air up there is quite pure. You know, there's not a lot of pollutants up there. But in addition, during the winter, we don't have moisture in the atmosphere that comes naturally from plants and so forth. And so in the summertime, we have a little bit more moisture. Obviously, right now, it's actually turning quite a bit more humid. The humidity and those little tiny droplets of water can sometimes attract, you know, small other little particles in the atmosphere. So we get this summer haze. I think we're pretty familiar with that, especially when it gets humid, it gets hazy. Again, those are those water droplets collecting a few other little fragments of things out there. And so it doesn't end up being as clear. Now, we can have some very clear nights during the summer. But in general, we do get that little bit of summer haze.
Wow, science. Fabulous. All right, you talked about the planets that we can see out there, Mark, Saturn and Mars. And Dawn from Rochester has a question for us. Hey, Dawn, how you doing tonight?
Hey, Mark. Love
hey,
you.
Dawn.
Listened to you for years. Where hey. Mars is right now, what is the planet or star exactly to the right of it, up a little bit by maybe 1 or 2 degrees?
Right, it's pretty close by. Not quite as bright as Mars or Saturn or Antares. It's a star named Dushuba. Dushuba is an Arabic word. It means the head of the scorpion, and that's exactly what that star is. It's the head of the scorpion in the skies. Mars, actually, and this will be great to watch, if we can catch a couple of more clear nights or even partly cloudy nights the rest of this week, one of the things you'll notice is that Mars will gradually shift a little bit to the left of that star. It's been doing that for the past few weeks, but tonight it happens to be about as close as it's going to get to that star. It'll start moving away from it to the left.
and that's called Dishuba. Never heard of that one before, Mark. Love it. Okay, we've got Carol calling in from Manchester. Carol, thanks for joining us tonight. And if anybody else wants to call in, the number again, 1-800-639-2211. Carol, what's your question?
Good evening. I'm in Manchester, and I'm looking at Mars right now to the left of the moon. But at 4 o'clock in the constellation Scorpio, there seems to be something flickering that has red, white, and blue flickers in it. I'm wondering what that is.
Mark, you're a big fan.
To the naked eye, I can see the red glow, but when I use my binoculars, I can see red, white, and blue.
Mark, I know you're a big fan of Scorpio.
A little bit to below Mars or to its left?
It's the constellation Scorpio, which I think is what I'm looking at. Right. If Mars is at 4 o'clock, this constellation or this star is at 7.
Okay. What you're seeing is the star Antares. Now, as it turns out, stars, especially bright stars near the horizon, are going through a somewhat thicker part of the atmosphere. It's basically coming in on an angle instead of coming straight down if you were looking at a star above you. And so what ends up happening, going through this thicker part of the atmosphere, and I think we've all noticed this before, say on a hot day, you can see the waves of heat as we describe it. This is actually changes in the density of the air. Now, bear with me because I'm getting to the answer. So what ends up happening is the atmosphere is slightly different densities. So the light from the star bends, and this is just like sending light through, say, one of those crystals that people hang in their windows. It bends the light, and it creates a little bit of a rainbow effect. However, we're only dealing with a point. So instead of seeing the expanse of the rainbow, we just see tiny pieces of it. So you'll see the star flash red and then white, and then it'll go back to maybe blue, as you've been describing. So that's what's happening. It's sort of enhanced twinkling, if you want to think of it that way.
And is Antares part of Scorpio?
Yes, Antares is the brightest star in the Scorpion and is often considered its heart.
Oh, love it. Okay, so you talk a lot about some of the keys to look for in the summer sky, Mark. What are they?
Well, we've just talked about one. You know, when I tell folks to go outside, one of the key things to look for is this red star Antares. And in fact, most years we don't have Mars accompanying it. In fact, that doesn't happen all that often. So kind of a nice opportunity this year. And in fact, through this month, Mars will gradually work its way just above Antares during the latter part of this month. So great viewing to watch for that. But if Mars wasn't there, if Saturn wasn't there, you would see Dishuba that we described. That's the star just to the upper right of Mars. And if you draw a line from there to Antares, and then if you've got a pretty good view to the south, you may see a line of stars kind of curving down toward the horizon. You may not see that it curves back up, only because the very bottom section is right near the horizon. But this is the body and tail of the Scorpion. And then out in front, Dishuba being the head, scorpions have claws. I kind of think of them as miniature lobsters or crayfish or something. And so the claws extend from either side of the head and kind of hook out and then forward or out in the direction of Mars, actually out toward the moon. So that's one of the key things to look for. A second one, and the one that probably is really familiar to many of us, even if you're a very casual stargazer, the Big Dipper. The Big Dipper this time of year, always found in the northwest. It's a familiar pattern of stars, as I mentioned to most folks. 7 medium bright stars, all relatively close together. The handle is on the left and a little bit higher, and then there are 4 stars that make, not quite a square, but, well, that's the Dipper part right there. That's a key constellation to look for pretty much any time of year, and certainly in the summer months, kind of helps you out in some of the other things that are up in the north and the northwest. And then finally, and this one's really pretty high above us right now, high in the east, there are 3 bright stars forming a very nice-looking triangle. The highest and brightest of the trio is Vega. The lowest of the trio, and that's basically heading back down toward the southeast horizon, so well to the left of the Scorpion, but also still quite high in the sky, a star named Altair. The third star, which is just a little bit lower than Vega and in the east, that is the star Deneb. So the three of them are called the Summer Triangle. And again, that's another key. If you can find those three things, you've really found what I consider, you know, the go-to points in the summer sky.
So how do we use, like, the Big Dipper to find other stars?
Right. Well, one of the things that the Big Dipper is terrific about is it'll find the North Star for you. Well, you have to do just a little bit of work. It's pretty simple. The stars that are on the outer edge of the bowl, so as you're looking at it tonight, it would be on the lower side of it. The two stars there, if you draw a line and extend it to the right and a little bit higher, and you're going to go distance-wise about the same distance that the Big Dipper is long, so kind of give you an approximate idea there. But you're going to end up halfway up in the sky, due north, and there's a star there. It's not the brightest star in the sky, but it's definitely a star you've heard of before or perhaps seen before. That is the North Star. So that's very helpful in terms of finding that. Now, you can, if you use the other portion of the Dipper, the handle part of the Dipper, you'll notice, of course, it has a bit of a curve to it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you follow this curve, and kind of now you're working to the left and a little bit lower, there's a brilliant star over there. It's well to the right of the moon, a star named Arcturus. Now, there's a way you can actually remember that. Because the curve of the handle, another name for curve is arc, if you follow the arc, A-R-C, you come to Arcturus. So that's the old rule of thumb. You arc to Arcturus.
This should be so easy. And Mark, does the Big Dipper, the appearance of it, change over time?
Well, yes, although I don't think that most of us are going to witness that. It'll take, another 10 or 20,000 years. But those stars are actually in motion. Now, we don't think of it that way, and certainly in the time of recorded history for humans, the stars have not changed their positions so much so that, I mean, if somehow the Greeks kind of leapt forward in time, they would still recognize the sky just the same as they had back 2,000 years ago. But those stars are actually in motion, and it's kind of curious. The middle five stars in the Dipper, they're all actually part of an old group of stars that used to be closer together, but they basically stay more or less in the same spot. They're moving away from us is what it amounts to. But the star on the very end of the Dipper, as you're looking at it tonight, is moving down. The star on the outer right corner of the Dipper is moving more to the right. So over time, the Dipper actually kind of gets stretched out and distorted. But again, unless you're planning to be around for about 20,000 years, you probably won't notice it.
All right. We're taking a tour of the cosmos with Mark Breen, director of the Planetarium at the Fairbanks Museum. If you have a question about the night sky, you can call us at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can email us at community@vpr.net. And we've got Robert calling in from West Rutland, getting a lot of great calls, Mark. Robert, what's your question?
Hey, good evening.
Good evening.
Hey, Robert.
How are you doing?
Good. Yourself?
I'm doing well. I'm a photographer, and I'm in West Rutland, and the moon is to my right. And I'm just wondering where I should point my camera tonight to get the best picture of the meteor shower.
Ah, that's always a bit of a challenge. I guess the way that I kind of imagine it best, and it's one of those tricky things, meteors can appear almost in any quarter of the sky. So it's not as though there's a very specific direction. But having said that, the constellation that's connected with the Perseid meteor shower, Perseus, comes up in the northeast after midnight. So I guess I would favor the eastern half of the sky. I don't know how wide a camera lens you have, but the wider the better. Because, the more of the sky that you can catch, the better the opportunity to see some of those shooting stars.
That's great. Melissa's calling now from Westfield. Melissa, thanks for joining us this evening.
Good evening. How are you?
We're great.
Good. How are you?
Thank you for doing this. I was just curious if you could talk more about the myths behind the constellations, and if you could explain what the W is in the sky that I'm looking at from it's the right of the Big Dipper.
Ah, okay. Well, let's actually start with that. That's a great little spot to begin with. So we're looking off to the northeast, and indeed, there is a W shape there. That W is actually part of, if you've got a bit of imagination, a chair, a throne, really, because it belongs to the queen of the sky, Queen Cassiopeia. So if you look at that W and you extend the left side of it out one more star, you actually can see there's another fainter star out that way. That's the top of the seat of the chair. So the chair is actually almost sideways in the sky right now. Now, as you go to the bottom part of the seat, so to say, and getting over to the next section of the W, if you go up above sort of the middle star, there's another fainter star up in there, and that forms the seat. And then from there, hopefully you can see maybe three legs sticking off to the right. Obviously, this takes a little imagination, but that indeed is the queen. And she is part of this wonderful myth in the sky that has to do with basically her daughter, Andromeda. And Andromeda is probably a better known name in terms of the stars. Got a couple of things going for it. There is a galaxy known as the Andromeda Galaxy. That isn't quite it's not high enough to get a good view of just yet. It will be a little bit later tonight. But Andromeda is mixed up in a myth with the guy that our meteors are named after tonight, the Perseid meteor shower, named after Perseus. Perseus, a great hero in mythology, actually rescues the poor damsel in distress, Andromeda. And Andromeda is the daughter of the queen. The other myth that I'll throw in here right now, since we've been talking about the scorpion, he actually, and this is, we often get this question in our planetarium. People will come up and, you know, we'll describe the summer sky, and then people will ask, well, where's Orion? Because if there's a well-known constellation that you don't see in the summer, that's the one. Orion isn't there because of the scorpion. At least, again, this fits in with the myth. The myth is that Orion was so great and so powerful that he dismissed any challenge to him. And in fact, the gods and goddesses on Mount Olympus got a little bit nervous about this. He was basically getting a little out of hand. And so they decided that they needed to get rid of him. So they came up with a great plan. They couldn't send anything really large or powerful because Orion was large and powerful. So instead they sent this little tiny scorpion. The scorpion stung Orion. He kind of looked at this little tiny scorpion, thought it was nothing to worry about, but the scorpion stung Orion and killed him, and when Orion died, he fell on top of the scorpion. They were both dead. Well, the gods and goddesses had to do something with these two very famous characters, but they decided to place them on opposite sides of the sky because they were worried that if they saw each other again, they might start fighting and mess up the sky. So we see the scorpion in the southern skies in the summer. When the scorpion leaves the sky during the fall, Orion then reappears. He comes into view generally late November into December and is out into the early part of spring. When he disappears, the scorpion returns.
Wow, that is fascinating. Hey, Mark, the one thing you have to love is the questions we're getting tonight kind of indicate that people are seeing the night sky tonight. So there must be clear skies around Vermont, right?
Yep. Like I said, we had that clearing trend coming in. We had that disturbance that went by mostly this morning. So one of those lucky things, we kind of timed it out just right.
Now, we were talking about the Big Dipper, and Bruce wrote to ask this question. The orientation of the Big Dipper changes over time. The Dipper part pointing up in the summer, down in the fall, is that correct?
Yes. So what's happening is actually not the Dipper that's changing. It's actually us. As we go around the sun, okay, I guess we have two motions to think about: our orbit around the sun and the fact that we're spinning on our axis. So we can see part of what he's talking about even through the nighttime hours. As I mentioned, you know, the meteors will be a little better after midnight. The moon will be out of the picture. So if you were to be out, let's say, tomorrow morning, 3:30, 4 o'clock, you would see the Big Dipper very differently. It'll be over in the northeast, and so that change, basically just the fact that the Earth is spinning. But also, through the course of the seasons, as we go around the sun, it does gradually pivot. But it pivots very predictably, and that North Star that we mentioned earlier is the North Star because it's right above the Earth's North Pole. So what happens is, if you're thinking about this motion of the Big Dipper, it basically pivots around the North Star. So that's kind of the anchor point, if you want to think of it that way, in the sky. It's one of the reasons it is the North Star. It never moves. But the Big Dipper appears to make its sweep around it. So indeed, in the summer, it comes down into the northwest. During the fall, it kind of scrapes low across the northern horizon. That brings it up into the northeast during the winter. And during the spring, it comes almost right over the top of the sky and then starts curving back down into the northwest next summer.
All right, Mark, we got a lot of calls. We better get another one in here. Here's Barbara from Holland calling us tonight. Hi, Barbara. What's going on?
Hi, Mark. We were just wondering if we had seen the International Space Station go over. It was traveling just about due east from the west. It's much larger, much brighter, and traveling much faster than most satellites would be.
That is entirely possible. It was one of the things that I did not click on my list of viewing times for that. We've actually seen that on occasions before. There's a great website that you can actually go to, and you can find some of those. There are actually a number of them you can go to. But specifically, there's a place called spaceweather.com, and on that page, you will see a link specifically for viewing the International Space Station. You can also go to the NASA.gov website, and that also has links to be able to see it. It'll show you, it'll actually have a list. You basically type in your zip code, and it'll be able to be very specific about your location, how long you will see it, and what direction it will travel.
We're taking a tour of the cosmos tonight on VPR with Mark Breen, the Planetarium Director at the Fairbanks Museum. Let us know what you can see wherever you are, and you can send your questions about the night sky to community@vpr.net, or you can call 1-800-639-2211. I just love that tune. Welcome back to VPR's Eye on the Sky Stargazing Party. I'm Rick Singeri with Mark Breen of Eye on the Sky fame and Planetarium Director at the Fairbanks Museum. Tonight's program is presented in collaboration with the Fairbanks Museum in St. Johnsbury. We're taking a tour of the cosmos, watching for the Perseid meteor shower. Let us know your questions about the night sky. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also email us at community@vpr.net. And, Mark, I think you're going to love the next couple calls. First, we're going to hear from Sadie in Braintree. Sadie, good evening.
Hi, I'm Sadie, and I was wondering if there are any other planets that we can see today other than Mars and Saturn.
Mark, what do you think?
That's a great question. Right now, those are the only two that are out in the evening sky. And we actually had back in the spring, most of the visible planets were out. But for right now, that's going to be it. Although, and this will be something that will be coming up at the end of this month, we actually have this really interesting meeting of Jupiter and Venus. It's going to be low in the west, and it'll be in the twilight, so there'll only be a kind of a short period of time. I'm thinking back in terms of the actual date. I'm pretty sure that it is August 27th or 8th. We'll actually have that information up on our website, and I'll be talking about it on the Eye on the Night Sky. But the idea will be that you'll be able to go outside between 10 of 8 and 8:05, and Jupiter and Venus will be very close together, like less than the width of your pinky apart. They will be super close together, again, just for a short period of time, but that's that will be coming up. So those are really, you know, Saturn and Mars right now are all we have to look at in the evenings.
Wow, that's exciting. Sadie, thanks for that great question. Kayan Saka is with us calling from Barrie. Kayan Saka, how are you?
Hi. So I was wondering, so how do the stars get there, even though all the dust clouds are far off in space?
Do you mean that the dust clouds that made the stars are far away?
Yes.
Ah, okay. Well, what happens is, and you're right, there are dust clouds and they're way, way, way off in space. But if they form a star, then basically all of that dust gets pulled into becoming the star or potentially planets going around that star. And so when we see the stars themselves, they've already used that material to be, you know, to form and to create things like the stars and the planets. And so when we're seeing dust, that's material that either was a star and then it got, you know, it may have exploded and spread apart, or it's in the process of forming something, but it hasn't done so yet.
Excellent. Now, Jonathan wrote to us, Mark, to ask, well, first of all, say that he saw a shooting star, wants to know how fast that shooting star would be moving.
Ah, shooting stars. Now, most of their speed is actually due to the Earth. And our Earth orbits the sun. You don't necessarily feel this, but right now you're going 66,000 miles an hour. So in some ways, that's the answer, that those fragments are getting basically pushed into our atmosphere as we push into them, so about 60,000 miles an hour. But they can vary anywhere from 40,000 to 90,000 miles an hour. But it is very, very fast.
Wow. So we're talking about the Perseid meteor shower this evening because it's happening the next few nights. And, Mark, I could be making this up, but I've heard that we are in for a big Perseid year this year. Is that true? And why?
Well, that is certainly the anticipation. this is one of those, and I guess I know from the other hat that I wear in terms of weather forecasting, that forecasts sometimes don't work out. But indeed, there is the potential for more Perseids this year, and that's because in terms of meteor showers, I guess, and maybe this will kind of help in terms of a bit of a background on this, is that meteors, especially meteor showers, they are the result of a debris field coming from a comet. Now, comets orbit the sun just like the planets, except they orbit in very kind of long, stretched-out orbits, and they can kind of orbit at various angles. But here's what happens. As the comet gets close to the sun, the sun vaporizes the ice that it's made out of, but the ice has particles of rock as well. So the particles of rock get released all along its path, and then they stay in its path because there's nothing to move it out of there except when we run into it. So the comet, in this particular case, is known as Comet Swift-Tuttle. It comes by the sun once every 133 years. But because the debris is all along its path, we have our annual event of the Perseid meteors. Now, every year, or I should say every passage that it makes, Jupiter's gravity affects the comet's path. Jupiter's gravity also affects the debris. So what they've been looking at, and this is mainly courtesy of some of the amazing computer technology that we now have, they are specifically looking at tracks of this comet from the years 1079, 1479, and 1862, and they think that those tracks, leaving fresh debris may all kind of intersect this year. So the estimate is instead of 60 meteors per hour, and that's the average for the Perseids at their peak, 60 per hour, or about one a minute, 200 per hour, which is about one every 20 seconds. And so, again, if that happens, and the best chance of that taking place will be tomorrow night and again on Friday night, it'll be quite an amazing display.
Oh, that's outstanding news. Why are they called Perseids, or sometimes Tears of St. Lawrence?
Right. Well, the name Perseid comes from the constellation Perseus. Now, Perseus, he isn't up in the sky just yet, and again, it's one of the reasons that we'll actually see them a little better after midnight when his constellation comes up. But I can't tell you that I know a whole lot about Latin, but I do know this, that the IDS at the end, the IDS, means it's belonging to, in this case. So these shooting stars belong to Perseus. And so, and this is going back, surprisingly, not that long ago. Meteors are a relatively newcomer on the astronomy scene in terms of scientific study. They've been around, obviously, for millions of years, but in terms of understanding them, we're only going back to the 1800s. And so that's how they started naming them, where they came from or appeared to come from in the sky. So they appear to come from the neighborhood of the constellation Perseus. Now, there, of course, there is this other name, and it's a name that gets kind of casually thrown in at times. They have been known in the past as the Tears of St. Lawrence. St. Lawrence was a martyred Christian saint back in the very early days of the Christian church, so we're going back to, I think, the year 258, I think. Now, at that time, as Christianity was expanding, one of the things that was going on is that there were events that were already taking place at certain times of the year. And one of the things that was happening in early August was kind of a fertility and agricultural god known as Priapus. Now, Priapus, he was, somebody that they were basically honoring, hoping for a good harvest. And he was connected with another agricultural god, Acca Laurentia. So Laurentia was the mythical mother of Romulus and Remus, the founders of Rome. So you can see this, we're getting there. Laurentia is very similar sounding to the Italian Lorenzo, which anglicized is Lawrence. And so they were basically having celebrations this time of year anyway. They just kind of tied the two of them together, and so it became part of this feast of the saint, St. Lawrence. That's how they became known, the Tears of St. Lawrence.
So many people want to ask you questions tonight, Mark, so let's get to Charlie okay. Calling from Weybridge. Charlie, thanks for joining us on this Eye on the Sky stargazing party tonight. What's your question for Mark?
Thank you, Mark and Rick, for a wonderful program. My father was a navigator in World War II in a bomber plane, and he used to love to show me when I was a kid the constellations Cassiopeia, which you've talked about, the Seven Sisters of the Pleiades, and Orion's Belt. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the latter two.
Sure. Orion, as I mentioned, he's basically out of the sky right now because the Scorpion is there. So he won't be part of our skies tonight. Although by late August, I will say, if you happen to be an early riser, Orion comes up just as twilight arrives by the end of August. But in between Cassiopeia that we did talk about and Orion, there are these little kind of, it's a patch of light, really, when you first look at it. These are known as the Seven Sisters. They're also known as the Pleiades, and they, too, are a fall and winter constellation. So they are great objects to look for in the skies. It's just not something we're going to see tonight.
All right. Now, Christine has a call. She a question she's calling in from Enfield, New Hampshire. Christine, thanks so much for your call. What's your question? Oh, turn your radio down.
Hello?
Christine. Yeah, turn your radio down.
Turn the radio down.
Hi, Christine.
Hi. Well, I have two questions. The first one is we're lying on our backs. And by the way, this show is amazing. We really like it. So the handle of the Big Dipper, if you draw a line diagonally to the left, looking right above my head, there's a really bright star. I'd like to know what that is. My second question is, is there a reason why when you're looking up, you see lots of stars in a cluster? And then you'll look off over somewhere else and you'll just, you know, you'll see a few stars. Is there any reason why lots of stars are clustered together in some spots and not others?
Two great questions, Mark.
Sure. So the really brilliant star that you're seeing, well to the upper left of the Dipper, that's going to be Vega. Now, I'm just kind of basing this on your description. If it is more similar in height above the horizon, that would be Arcturus, but I think you're describing Vega. It's one of the brightest stars in the sky, so it's wonderfully bright. It has a hint of blue, actually, to it because it's a really hot star. Color of stars actually gives us an indication of their surface temperature. So that's identifying that. Now, you know, in terms of these clumps or clusters of stars, some of it certainly would be a bit of randomness that we have in our universe. But there are, and it's a tendency, that most stars are actually part of groups of stars. It's pretty, or it's less common, I guess I should say, that stars exist all by themselves as some individual random star. So our sun, in that regard, probably is an exception to that, although the more we're learning about motions in the sky, the more we're finding out that our sun may be part of what was once a collection of stars and is now dispersed. But where you're seeing these clumps or collections of stars, they haven't quite dispersed as much. Now, the previous caller, Charlie, that mentioned the Seven Sisters, now there's a group that isn't all that old, so they are still in a clump or cluster. And these are actually very helpful to scientists just in terms of understanding some of the things in our universe. Clumps or clusters of stars mean they are formed at the same time, or more or less the same time. They formed out of the same parent material. So in some ways, the sisters really are sisters. But it gives us a way to start aging stars. In other words, I mean, let's face it, our sun is approximately 5 billion years old. Nobody was around to watch it form. So in order to understand how stars age, how long they've been around, we actually use these clusters of stars, and we start aging them the way that you might. You know, somebody actually just kind of threw a bunch of pictures on the table, portraits of people. You probably could arrange them more or less in age order. And that's what we do with the stars. By ordering their age, we start understanding what stars look like at different ages. And that's really helpful to basically understand how stars change over millions of years.
So all this stuff you're teaching us tonight, Mark, how does it all fit into the Milky Way?
Well, the Milky Way is, in some ways, it's home. We are in the Milky Way. It doesn't necessarily look like that when you're looking at it in the skies, merely because, well, it's pretty hard to see it in terms of what it really looks like, only because you're inside it. So you're on the inside looking out. So in some ways, as you're looking out there tonight, everything you see is in the Milky Way galaxy. We don't see any stars in distant galaxies, not with our eyes. Telescopes, even most backyard telescopes can't do that. Only some of the very powerful telescopes are able to see individual stars in distant galaxies. So everything we're looking at is in this Milky Way galaxy. Now, with a lot of careful study and so forth, the Milky Way galaxy is basically a big, flat, round disk. It kind of bulges a little bit in the middle, but it's pretty much a disk. And we're about two-thirds of the way out from the center. Now, if you're looking at the Milky Way tonight, and one of the things we've actually tied in, a few things that will help you locate it. Tonight, it's not as easy with the moon out there, but another 10 days to 2 weeks, and you'll have some great views of the Milky Way. It stretches from the south right near the tail end of the Scorpion. It goes up high into the east where the summer triangle is, and I just mentioned before the previous color of Vega up high, and then it drops down right into that W that most people look for with the Queen, Cassiopeia. So that's where you can see the Milky Way in the sky. But what you're really seeing is you're looking sideways through that disk that I described, this flat, round disk. Since you're looking sideways, you're looking through the thickest part of it. If you look on either side, you're basically looking up or down, and so you're looking out away from the Milky Way.
This is VPR's Eye in the Sky Stargazing Party with Mark Breen. We've got another call, Mark, from Andrew in Fletcher. Andrew, thanks for calling tonight.
Good evening. I'm curious why constellations have been associated with certain times of the year in regards to birthdays and astrological signs.
Ah, great question, because, well, one of the ones we've been talking about, Scorpio, is one of the horoscope or zodiac signs, and indeed, the time period that it's associated with, pretty much the end of October through the first 3 weeks of November, dates back to when the Persians and the Babylonians were organizing the sky, coming up with different constellations. But one of the things that they were watching very closely were the movements of the planets, the moon, and the sun. And so the planets and the moon and the sun all pass through this certain group of constellations that we know is the zodiac or sometimes the horoscope. And so that's the connection in terms of dates. Now, specifically, going back about 2,500, 3,000 years ago, the sun was right in the front part of the scorpion, say, just to the left of where we see the moon tonight, right toward the end of October, and gradually moved through those stars. Now, what that means is, of course, you can't see Scorpio during Scorpio, but that was okay with them. They were actually attributing things, well, like the time of year was influenced by that star group. In other words, if you think of a scorpion, scorpions are kind of dangerous. You know, you get stung by one, you might get sick. There are a few that are lethally poisonous out there. So the scorpion itself was a symbol of sickness and death. Now, if you think about your garden during that time of year, late October and November, your garden looks pretty sick out there. You know, the frost is wiping things out. And so there was a connection to what was happening here on the Earth with what has been influenced, so to say, influencing the sun up in the sky. So each of those constellations has an influence. And again, we're going back 2,500 years ago before we understood, you know, things like how the weather operates and that type of thing. But that's where that connection all came from.
Mark, we have another young star fan. Eliana is calling from Ferrisburg. Eliana, good evening. Thanks for calling.
She's a little shy, but she was wondering if there were any dog constellations and if there were any stories behind them.
Oh, there are. There are a couple of different ones. The ones that, and they're not really easy to see, but it's worth taking a look. If you, since we happen to be looking in the direction, well, one of the directions that we've talked about tonight, the Big Dipper. Now, as you look at the Big Dipper, there's actually, there are a pair of dogs out there. They're not really easy to see at all. But if you look at the Big Dipper and you look at the handle, and then you drop down below the handle, you'll see there's really, let's just call them two very modest stars between there and the horizon. Those are two dogs. They were actually, there's not a lot of history to them because they're a very faint constellation, but there are a couple of dogs there. But the dog that you really want to see, it isn't out in the sky right now, but it's definitely worth kind of putting on your list of things to see this winter, and that is Canis Major, which is the great dog. The brightest star, and that is named Sirius. Actually, for any Harry Potter fans, that indeed is the same as Sirius Black. J.K. Rowling used some of the star names as some of her characters, so that's kind of interesting. And, of course, he also, in the story, turns into a dog, so that all kind of ties in. But the constellation Canis Major, the great dog, is one of the hunting dogs of Orion. So, you know, we've heard a lot of questions about some of these star groups that are winter groups. We do have some wonderfully bright stars in the winter. You'll just have to wait a few months to see them.
Now, Mark, we gave a lot of love tonight to the Big Dipper, but David in Colchester wants to know about another constellation. David, thanks for joining us. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
What's your question?
Hey, I used to be able to find a Little Dipper, but I can't seem to find it anymore. I thought that the Big Dipper poured into the Little Dipper. How can I find that?
Sure. Well, we've given you a couple of clues that you can use, so I'll just remind you. that if you use the two stars that are on the outer right edge of the Dipper, those two stars, you know, draw a line and then extend that line to the upper right, and that takes you to the North Star. That's the key to finding the Little Dipper. Now, the stars are, no question, they are much fainter than the Big Dipper. But what you're going to see tonight is a fainter line of three stars. So you look at the North Star, going up three stars, they kind of curve up and a little bit to the left. That's the handle. And then that last star that I mentioned ties into three others. They make a small box of stars up there, and that's the Dipper part itself. So it's upside down compared to the Big Dipper. Again, that rotation that we talked about earlier tonight, when the Big Dipper swings around and is high above during the late winter and spring, then the Little Dipper is basically right side up. So they kind of switch around their roles that way. But that's how to find it. The key thing, finding the North Star.
Now, Mark, we have heard from a great group of young stargazers this evening, and we often hear from parents who are looking for suggestions on how to get beginners interested in astronomy. So where should they start?
Oh, there are so many wonderful resources these days. You know, certainly there are great books about the stars. There are some great things. You know, one of the things I always think is a challenge is, what's going on tonight? What should I be going out and looking for? Certainly, you can tune into our Eye in the Night Sky programs in the afternoon, and you can listen to the podcasts on that. We do focus in specifically on what you can go outside and see. But if there are a couple of other resources that I find wonderfully fascinating, one of them is to get, we call it a desktop planetarium. So in other words, you can actually get one of these, and now, of course, desktop, that's probably a bit of an old reference at this point. You can also find apps for your phone these days in your tablets. One of them is called Stellarium, and Stellarium is a wonderful program. You can see what's going on, not just tonight, but you can move forward and backward in time. I always have a lot of fun with that. There is also an app for phones called Starwalk. It's one of several, but it's one that comes to mind immediately. And one of the things I like about that is that you can hold it up to the sky, and it will have, you can kind of change the settings around, but it'll actually show you what constellation you're looking at. And so it starts to help describe the sky. Now, on the other hand, sometimes a book is just the way to go. And if there's a book that I would have to recommend, it's a simple title. It's called The Stars. It's actually by an author, H.A. Ray, author-illustrator. He and his wife wrote and illustrated the Curious George books. But this book, The Stars, while it sometimes looks a little cartoony, a little bit too young, I've actually used it for college courses. It's got a complete range of star information, from some very basic what do you see to some of the more complicated things in terms of how the universe works.
Mark, we have just a few seconds left. We've talked about a lot of different constellations and stars. Anything we missed that people should be looking for tonight?
Wow, I've only got four more hours of material, Rick. So, I don't think we've missed anything. I think one of the things that I, you know, tend to look for, you know, when I go out, I really love the summer triangle above. There's actually this wonderful story that comes from parts of China and Japan, where the three stars are actually a part of, well, not exactly a love triangle, but the star high above, Vega, is the goddess of weaving, and the star below, Altair, is the handsome cowherd. And they are kind of unfortunately separated by the Milky Way. It's a tragic, sad love tale.
Oh, that's lovely. Great way to end it. I want to thank everyone for joining us on tonight's Eye on the Sky Stargazing Party. And Mark, thanks to you for being with us as well. You are a gem, and it's always great learning new things from you.
Well, thanks. And thanks for everybody that called in and wrote in. I love answering your questions.
Best calls ever this year. Tonight's broadcast was presented collaboration with the Fairbanks Museum and Planetarium in St. Johnsbury, and thanks to WHYY for their studio space tonight as well. This program was produced by Liam Connors, with production assistance from Sarah Matthews. Mary Williams directed the program, and I'm Rick Singeri. Thanks so much for listening. Now get out there and look at the stars.